He circles the whole area, windmilling his arm to cover the entire security perimeter and the road that gives access to it. The entirety is mine. I report to Manila. So, it is a very small chain of command for such a large area. Secrecy is of paramount importance. Your first and highest order is to preserve absolute secrecy at all costs. Lieutenants Maury and Goto blurt "Hi," and bow. Addressing Maury, Captain Noda continues, The housing area will appear to be a prison camp for special prisoners. Its existence may be known to some on the outside. The local people will see trucks going in and out along the road and will guess as much. Turning to Goto Dango, he says, The existence of the special security zone, however, will be totally unknown to the outside world. Your work will proceed under the cover of the jungle, which is extraordinarily dense here. It will be invisible to the enemy's observation planes. Lieutenant Maury jerks back as if a bug has just flown into his eye. To him, the idea of enemy observation planes over Luzon is completely bizarre. MacArthur is nowhere near the Philippines. Goto Dango, on the other hand, has been to New Guinea. He knows what happens to Nipponese army units who try to resist MacArthur in the jungles of the Southwest Pacific. He knows that MacArthur is coming, and obviously so does Captain Noda. More importantly, so do the men in Tokyo who sent Noda down to accomplish this mission, whatever it is. They know. Everyone knows we are losing the war. Everyone important, that is. Lieutenant Goto, you are not to discuss any details of your work with Lieutenant Maury except insofar as they pertain to pure logistics, road building, worker schedules, and so on. Noda is addressing this to both men. The clear implication is that if Goto gets loose-lipped, Maury is expected to turn him in. Lieutenant Maury, you are dismissed. Maury grunts out another, Hi! And makes himself scarce. Lieutenant Goto bows.
Captain Noda, please permit me to say that I am honored to have been selected to construct these fortifications.
The stoic look on Noda's face dissolves for a moment. He turns away from Goto Dango and paces across the floor of the tent for a moment, thinking, then turns to face him again.
It is not a fortification.
Goto Dango is practically startled right out of his boots for a moment. Then he thinks, a gold mine. They must have discovered an immense gold deposit in this valley. Or diamonds?
You must not think as if you were building a fortification, Noda says solemnly.
A mine?
Goto Dango says, but he says it weakly. He is already realizing that it does not make much sense. It would be insane to put so much effort into mining gold or diamonds at this point in the war. Nippon needs steel, rubber, and petroleum, not jewelry. Perhaps some new superweapon. His heart nearly bursts from excitement. But Captain Noda's stare is as bleak as the fat muzzle of a Tommy gun.
It is a long-term storage facility for vital war-making materials, Captain Noda finally says.
He goes on to explain in general terms how the facility is to be built. It is to be a network of intersecting shafts bored through hard volcanic rock. Its dimensions are surprisingly small given the amount of effort that will be spent on building it. They won't be able to store much here. Enough ammunition for a regiment to fight for a week, perhaps, assuming that they make minimal use of heavy weapons and get their food off the land. But those supplies will be almost inconceivably well protected. Goto Dango sleeps that night in a hammock stretched between two trees, protected by mosquito netting. The jungle emits a fantastic din. Captain Noda's sketches looked familiar, and he is trying to place them. Just as he's falling asleep, he remembers cutaway views of the pyramids of Egypt that his father had shown him in a picture book, showing the design of the pharaoh's tombs. A horrible thought comes to him then. He is building a tomb for the emperor. When Nippon falls to MacArthur, Hirohito will carry out the rite of seppuku. His body will be flown out of Nippon and brought to Bundok, and buried in the chamber that Goto Dengo is building. He has the nightmare of being buried alive in a black chamber, the gray image of the Emperor's face fading to black as the last brick is rammed home on its bed of mortar. He sits in absolute darkness, knowing that Hirohito is there with him, afraid to move. He is a little boy in an abandoned mine chamber, naked and soaked with icy water. His flashlight has died. Before it flickered out, he thought he saw the face of a demon. Now he hears only the drip, drip of groundwater into the sump. He can stay here and die, or he can dive into the water again and swim back. When he wakes up, it's raining, and the sun has climbed free of the horizon somewhere. He rolls out of his hammock and walks naked in the warm rain to wash himself. Goto Dengo has a job to do. Computer. Lieutenant Colonel Earl Comstock of the Electrical Till Corporation and the United States Army, in that order, prepares for today's routine briefing for his subordinate, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, much as a test pilot readies himself to be ripped into the stratosphere with a hot rocket engine under his ass. He turns in early the night before, wakes up late, talks to his aide, and makes sure that A, plenty of hot coffee is available, and B, none of it will be given to Waterhouse. He gets two wire recorders set up in the room, in case either goes on the fritz, and brings in a team of three crack stenographers with loads of technical savvy. He has a couple of fellows in his section, also ETC employees during peacetime, who are real math whizzes, so he brings them in too. He gives them a little pep talk.
I do not expect you fellows to understand what the fuck Waterhouse is talking about. I'm going to be running after him as fast as I can. You just hug his legs and hold on for dear life so that I can sort of keep his backside in view as long as possible.
Comstock is proud of this analogy, but the math whizzes seem baffled. Testily, he fills them in on the always tricky literal versus figurative dichotomy. Only 20 minutes remain before Waterhouse's arrival. Right on schedule, Comstock's aide comes through the room with a tray of Benzedrine tablets. Comstock takes two, attempting to lead by example.
"Where's my darn chalkboard team?" he demands, as the powerful stimulant begins to rev up his pulse.
Into the room come two privates, equipped with blackboard erasers and damp chamois cloths, plus a three-man photography team. They set up a pair of cameras aimed at the chalkboard, plus a couple of strobe lights, and lay in a healthy stock of film rolls. He checks his watch. They are running 5 minutes behind schedule. He looks out the window and sees that his Jeep has returned. Waterhouse must be in the building.
"Where is the extraction team?" he demands.
Sergeant Graves is there a few moments later.
"Sir, we went to the church as directed and located him and,
he coughs against the back of his hand.
"And what?"
"And who is more like it, sir?"
says Sergeant Graves, sotto voce.
"He's in the lavatory right now, cleaning up, if you know what I mean."
He winks.
"Oh,"
says Earl Comstock, cottoning onto it.
"After all," Sergeant Graves says, "you can't blow out the rusty pipes of your organ unless you have a nice little assistant to get the job properly done."
Comstock tenses.
"Sergeant Graves, it is critically important for me to know, did the job get properly done?"
Graves furrows his brow as if pained by the very question.
"Oh, by all means, sir. We wouldn't dream of interrupting such an operation. That's why we are late, begging your pardon."
"Don't mention it,"
Comstock says, slapping Graves heartily on the shoulder.
"That is why I try to give my men broad discretion. It has been my opinion for quite some time that Waterhouse is badly in need of some relaxation. He concentrates a little too hard on his work. Sometimes I frankly cannot tell whether he is saying something very brilliant or just totally incoherent. And I think you have made a pivotal, Sergeant Graves, a pivotal contribution to today's meeting by having the good sense to stand off long enough for Waterhouse's affairs to be set in order."
Comstock realizes that he is breathing very fast, and his heart is pounding madly. Perhaps he overdid the Benzedrine? Waterhouse drifts into the room 10 minutes later on flaccid legs, as if he had inadvertently left his own skeleton behind in bed. He barely makes it to his designated seat and thuds into it like a sack of guts, popping a few strands of wicker out of its bottom. He is breathing raggedly through his mouth, blinking heavy eyelids frequently.
"Looks like today is going to be a milk run, men," Comstock announces brightly.
Everyone except Waterhouse snickers. Waterhouse has been in the building for a quarter of an hour, and it took at least that long for Sergeant Graves to drive him here from the church, and so it has been at least half an hour. And yet, to look at him, you'd think that it had happened 5 minutes ago.
"Someone pour that man a cup of coffee," Comstock orders.
Someone does.
Being in the military is amazing. You give orders and things happen.
Waterhouse does not drink or even touch the coffee, but at least it gives his eyes something to focus on. Those orbs wander around under their rumpled lids for a while like AK-AK guns trying to track a housefly before finally fixing on the white coffee mug. Waterhouse clears his throat at some length, as if preparing to speak, and the room goes silent. It remains silent for about 30 seconds. Then Waterhouse mumbles something that sounds like coy. The stenographers take it down in unison.
Beg pardon, says Comstock.
One of the math whizzes says,
"He might be talking about coy functions. I think I saw them when I was flipping through a graduate math textbook once."
"I thought he was saying quantum something," says the other ETC man.
"Coffee,"
Waterhouse says, and heaves a deep sigh.
"Waterhouse," says Comstock, "how many fingers am I holding up?"
Waterhouse seems to realize that there are other people in the room now. He closes his mouth, and his nostrils flare as air begins to rush through them. He tries to move one of his hands, realizes that he is sitting on it, and shifts heavily to and fro until it flops loose. He gets his eyes all the way open, providing a really good, clear view of that coffee mug. He yawns, stretches, and farts.
"The Nipponese crypto system that we call Azure is the same thing as the German system that we call Pufferfish," he announces. "Both of them are also related somehow to another newer crypto system I have dubbed Arethusa. All of these have something to do with gold, probably gold mining operations of some sort in the Philippines."
Whammo!
The stenographers go into action. The photographer fires off his strobes, even though there's nothing to take pictures of, just nerves. Comstock glances beadily at his wire recorders, makes sure those reels are spinning. He is a little unnerved by how rapidly Waterhouse is coming up to speed, but one of the responsibilities of leadership is to mask one's own fears, to project confidence at all times. Comstock grins and says,
"You sound awfully sure of yourself, Waterhouse. I wonder if you can get me to feel the same level of confidence."
Waterhouse frowns at the coffee mug.
"Well, it's all math," he says. "If the math works, why then you should be sure of yourself. That's the whole point of math."
"So you have a mathematical basis for making this assertion?"
"Assertions," Waterhouse says. "Assertion number one is that Pufferfish and Azure are different names for the same crypto system. Assertion number two is that Pufferfish Azure is a cousin of Arethusa. Three, all of these crypto systems are related to gold. Four, mining. Five, Philippines."
Maybe you could just chalk those up on the blackboard as you go along," Comstock says edgily.
"Glad to,"
Waterhouse says. He stands up and turns toward the blackboard, freezes for a couple of seconds, then turns back around, lunges for the coffee mug, and drains it before Comstock or any of his aides can rip it from his grasp.
"Tactical error!"
Then Waterhouse chalks up his assertions. The photographer records it. The privates massage their chamois cloths and glance nervously in Comstock's direction.
"Now you have some sort of, mathematical proof for each one of these assertions," Comstock asks.
Math isn't his bag, but running meetings is, and what Waterhouse has just chalked up on that board looks to him like the rudiments of an agenda. And Comstock feels a lot better when he has an agenda. Without an agenda, he's like a grunt running around in the jungle without a map or a weapon. Well, sir, that's one way to look at it, Waterhouse says after some thought. But it is much more elegant to view all of these as corollaries stemming from the same underlying theorem. Are you telling me that you have succeeded in breaking Azure? Because if so, congratulations are in order, Comstock says. No, it is still unbroken, but I can extract information from it. This is the moment where the joystick snaps off in Comstock's hand. Still, he can pound haplessly on the control panel.
Well, would you mind taking them one at a time, at least?
Well, let's just take, for example, assertion 4, which is that Azure Pufferfish has something to do with mining. Waterhouse sketches out a freehand map of the Southwest Pacific Theater of Operations, from Burma to the Solomons, from Nippon to New Zealand. It takes him about 60 seconds. Just for grins, Comstock pulls a printed map out of his clipboard and compares it against Waterhouse's version. They are basically identical. Waterhouse draws a circle with a letter A in it at the entrance to Manila Bay. This is one of the stations that transmits Azure messages. You know that from Huffduff, correct?
That's right.
Is that on Corregidor? One of the smaller islands near Corregidor. Waterhouse draws another circle A in Manila itself, one in Tokyo, one in Rabaul, one in Penang, one in the Indian Ocean.
What's that?
Comstock asks. We picked up an Azure transmission from a German U-boat here, Waterhouse says.
How do you know it was a German U-boat?
Recognize the fist, Waterhouse says. So, this is the spatial arrangement of Azure transmitters, not counting the stations in Europe that are making pufferfish transmissions, and hence, according to assertion 1, are part of the same network. Anyway, now let us say that an Azure message originates from Tokyo on a certain date. We don't know what it says because we haven't broken Azure yet. We just know that the message went out to these places. Waterhouse draws lines radiating downward from Tokyo to Manila, Rabaul, Penang. Now, each one of these cities is a major military base. Consequently, each is the source of a steady stream of traffic communicating with all of the Nipponese bases in its region. Waterhouse draws shorter lines, radiating from Manila to various locations in the Philippines, and from Rabaul to New Guinea and the Solomons.
Correction, Waterhouse, Comstock says. We own New Guinea now.
But I'm going back in time, Waterhouse says. Back to 1943, when there were NIP bases all along the north coast of New Guinea and through the Solomons. So, let us say that within a brief window of time following this Azure message from Tokyo, a number of messages are transmitted from places like Rabaul and Manila to smaller bases in those areas. Some of them are in ciphers that we have learned how to break. Now, it is not unreasonable to suppose that some of these messages were sent out as a consequence of whatever orders were contained in that Azure message.
But those places send out thousands of messages a day, Comstock protests. What makes you think that you can pick out the messages that are a consequence of the Azure orders?
It's just a brute force statistics problem, Waterhouse says. Suppose that Tokyo sent the Azure message to Rabaul on October 15, 1943. Now, suppose I take all of the messages that were sent out from Rabaul on October 14th, and I index them in various ways. What destinations they were transmitted to, how long they were, and if we were able to decrypt them, what their subject matter was. Were they orders for troop movements, supply shipments? Then I take all of the messages that were sent out from Rabaul on October 16th, the day after the Azure message came in from Tokyo, and I run exactly the same statistical analysis on them. Waterhouse steps back from the chalkboard and turns into a blinding fusillade of strobe lights. You see, it is all about information flow. Information flows from Tokyo to Rabaul. We don't know what the information was, but it will in some way influence what Rabaul does afterwards. Rabaul is changed irrevocably by the arrival of that information, and by comparing Rabaul's observed behavior before and after that change, we can make inferences.
Such as?
Comstock says warily. Waterhouse shrugs. The differences are very slight. They hardly stand out from the noise. Over the course of the war, 31 Azure messages have gone out from Tokyo, so I have that many datasets to work with. Any one dataset by itself might not tell me anything, but when I combine all of the datasets together, giving me greater depth, then I can see some patterns. And one of the patterns that I most definitely see is that on the day after an Azure message went out to, say, Rabaul, Rabaul was much more likely to transmit messages having to do with mining engineers. This has ramifications that can be traced all the way back until the loop is closed.
Loop is closed?
Okay. Let's take it from the top. As your message goes from Tokyo to Rabaul, Waterhouse says, drawing a heavy line down the chalkboard joining those two cities. The next day, a message in some other cryptosystem, one that we have broken, goes from Rabaul to a submarine operating out of a base here in the Moluccas. The message states that the submarine is to proceed to an outpost on the north coast of New Guinea and pick up four passengers who are identified by name. From our archives, we know who these men are. Three aircraft mechanics and one mining engineer. A few days later, the submarine transmits from the Bismarck Sea stating that it has picked those men up. A few days after that, our waterfront spies in Manila inform us that the same submarine has showed up there. On the same day, another Azure message is transmitted from Manila back up to Tokyo. Waterhouse concludes, adding a final line to the polygon. Closing the loop.
But that could all be a series of random, unconnected events, says one of Comstock's math whizzes,
before Comstock can say it.
The Nips are desperate for aircraft mechanics. There's nothing unusual about this kind of message traffic.
But there is something unusual about the patterns, Waterhouse says. If, a few months later, another submarine is sent in the same way to pick up some mining engineers and some surveyors who have been trapped in Rabaul, and upon its arrival in Manila, another Azure message is sent from Manila up to Tokyo, it begins to look very suspicious.
I don't know, Comstock says, shaking his head. I'm not sure if I can sell this to the general staff. It's too much of a fishing expedition.
Correction, sir. It was a fishing expedition.
But now I'm back from the fishing expedition, and I've got the fish.
Waterhouse storms out of the room and down the hall toward his lab, half the fucking wing. Good thing Australia is a big continent, because Waterhouse is going to take all of it if he's not held sternly in check. 15 seconds later, he's back with a stack of ETC cards a foot high, which he pounds down on the tabletop.
It's all right here.
Comstock has never fired a gun in his life, but he knows card punching and reading machinery like a jarhead knows his Springfield, and he's not impressed.
Ah, Waterhouse, that stack of cards carries about as much information as a letter home to Mom. Are you trying to tell me?
No, this is just the summary, the result of the statistical analysis.
Why the hell did you punch it onto ETC cards? Why not just turn in a plain old type report like everyone else?
I didn't punch it, Waterhouse says. The machine punched it.
The machine punched it,
Comstock says very slowly.
Yes, when it was done performing the analysis.
Waterhouse suddenly breaks into his braying laugh.
You didn't think this was the raw inputs, did you?
Well, I...
The inputs filled several rooms. I had to run almost every message we have intercepted through the whole war through this analysis. Remember all those trucks I requisitioned a few weeks ago? Those trucks were just to carry the cards back and forth from storage.
Jesus Christ, Comstock says.
He remembers the trucks now, their incessant comings and goings, fender benders in the motor pool, exhaust fumes coming through his window, the enlisted men shoving heavy carts up and down the hallways, laden with boxes, running over people's feet, scaring the secretaries.
And the noise! Ah, the noise, the noise! From Waterhouse's goddamn machine!
Flower pots vibrating their way off file cabinets, standing waves in coffee cups.
Wait a sec,
says one of the ETC men, with the nasal skepticism of a man who has just realized he's being bullshitted.
I saw those trucks. I saw those cards. Are you trying to get us to believe that you were actually running a statistical analysis on each and every single one of those message decrypts, huh?
Waterhouse looks a little defensive.
Well, that was the only way to do it.
Comstock's math whiz is homing in for the kill now.
I agree that the only way to accomplish the analysis that is implied by that...
He waves at the mandala of intersecting polygons on Waterhouse's map,
is to go through all of those truckloads of old decrypts one by one. That is clear. That is not what we are objecting to.
What are you objecting to, then? The whiz laughs angrily.
I'm just worried about the inconvenient fact that there is no machine in the whole world that is capable of processing all of that data that fast.
Didn't you hear the noise? Waterhouse asks.
We all heard the goddamn noise, Comstock says. What does that have to do with anything?
Oh,
Waterhouse says, and rolls his eyes at his own stupidity.
That's right. Oh, sorry. Maybe I should have explained that part first.
What part? Comstock asks.
Dr. Turing of Cambridge University has pointed out that boobada boobada ho daddy yanga langa for jizma bing jingle, oh yeah,
Waterhouse says, or words to that effect. He pauses for breath and turns fatefully towards the blackboard.
Do you mind if I erase this?
A private lunges forward with an eraser. Comstock sinks into a chair and grips its arms. A stenographer reaches for a Benzedrine tablet. An ETC man chomps down on a number two lead pencil like a dog on a drumstick. Strobes flash. Waterhouse grabs a fresh stick of chalk, reaches up, and presses its tip to the immaculate slate. The crisp edge of the stick fractures with a slight pop, and a tiny spray of chalk particles drifts to the floor, spreading into a narrow parabolic cloud. Waterhouse bows his head for a minute, like a priest getting ready to stride up the aisle, and then draws a deep breath. The Benzedrine wears off 5 hours later, and Comstock finds himself sprawled across a table in a room filled with haggard, exhausted men. Waterhouse and the privates are pasty with chalk dust, giving them a ghoulish appearance. The stenographers are surrounded with used pads and frequently stop writing to flap their limp hands in the air like white flags. The wire recorders are spinning uselessly, one reel full and one empty. Only the photographer is still going strong, hitting that strobe every time Waterhouse manages to fill the chalkboard. Everything smells like underarm sweat. Comstock realizes that Waterhouse is looking at him expectantly.
See?
Waterhouse asks. Comstock sits up and glances furtively at his own legal pad, where he hoped to draw up an agenda. He sees Waterhouse's four assertions, which he copied down during the first 5 minutes of the meeting, and then nothing except a tangled field of spiky doodles surrounding the words bury and disinter. It behooves Comstock to say something.
This thing, the burying procedure, that's
the key feature, Waterhouse says brightly. See, these ETC card machines are great for input and output. We've got that covered. The logic elements are straightforward enough. What was needed was a way to give the machine memory so that it could, to use Turing's terminology, bury data quickly and just as quickly disinter it. So I made one of those. It's an electrical device, but its underlying principles would be familiar to any organ maker.
Could I, see it?
Comstock asks.
Sure, it's down in my lab.
Going to see it is more complicated. First, everyone has to use the toilet. Then the cameras and strobes have to be moved down to the lab and set up. When they've all filed in, Waterhouse is standing next to a giant rack of pipes with thousands of wires hanging out of it.
That's it?
Comstock says, when the group is finally assembled. Pea-sized drops of mercury are scattered around the floor like ball bearings. The flat soles of Comstock's shoes explode them into bursts rolling in all directions.
That's it. What did you call it again?
The RAM,
Waterhouse says. Random access memory. I was going to put a picture of a ram on it. You know, one of those sheeps with the big, huge, curly horns?
Yes.
But I didn't have time, and I'm not that good at drawing pictures. Each pipe is 4 inches in diameter and 32 feet long. There must be 100 of them at least. Comstock is trying to remember that requisition that he signed months ago. Waterhouse had ordered enough drain pipe to plumb a whole goddamn military base. The pipes are laid out horizontally, like a rank of organ pipes that has been knocked flat. Stuck into one end of each pipe is a little paper speaker ripped from an old radio. The speaker plays a signal, a note, that resonates in the pipe and creates a standing wave, Waterhouse says. That means that in some parts of the pipe, the air pressure is low and in other parts it is high. He is backing down the length of one of the pipes, making chopping motions with his hand. These U-tubes are full of mercury. He points to one of several U-shaped glass tubes that are plumbed into the bottom of the long pipe.
I can see that very plainly, Waterhouse, Comstock says.
Could you keep backing up to the next one?
He requests, peering over the photographer's shoulder through the viewfinder.
You're blocking my view. That's better. No, farther. Farther?
because he can still see Waterhouse's shadow.
That's good. Hit it.
The photographer pulls the trigger. The strobe flares.
If the air pressure in the organ pipe is high, it pushes the mercury down a little bit. If it's low, it sucks the mercury up. I put an electrical contact into each U-tube, just a couple of wires separated by an air gap. If those wires are high and dry, like because high air pressure in the organ pipe is shoving the mercury down away from them, no current flows. But if they are immersed in the mercury, because low air pressure in the organ pipes is sucking the mercury up to cover them, then current flows between them, because mercury conducts electricity. So the U-tubes produce a set of binary digits that is like a picture of the standing wave, a graph of the harmonics that make up the musical note that is being played on the speaker. We feed that vector back to the oscillator circuit that is driving the speaker so that the vector of bits keeps refreshing itself forever, unless the machine decides to write a new pattern of bits into it.
Oh, so the ETC machinery actually can control this thing?
Comstock asks. Again with the laugh.
That's the whole point. This is where the logic boards bury and disinter the data,
Waterhouse says. I'll show you.
And before Comstock can order him not to, Waterhouse is nodded to a corporal standing at the other end of the room, wearing the protective earmuffs that are generally issued to the men who fire the very largest artillery. That corporal nods and hits a switch. Waterhouse slams his hands over his ears and grins, showing a little too much gum for Comstock's taste. And then time stops, or something, as all of those pipes come alive, playing variations on the same low C. It's all Comstock can do not to drop to his knees. He has his hands over his ears, of course, but the sound's not really coming in through his ears. It is entering his torso directly, like X-rays. Hot sonic tongs are rummaging through his viscera, beads of sweat being vibrated loose from his scalp. His nuts are hopping around like Mexican jumping beans. The crescents of mercury in all those U-tubes are shifting up and down, opening and closing the contacts, but systematically. It is not turbulent sloshing around, but a coherent progression of discrete controlled shiftings, informed by some program. Comstock would draw his sidearm and put a bullet through Waterhouse's head, but he'd have to take one hand off one ear. Finally, it stops.
The machine just calculated the first 100 numbers in the Fibonacci sequence, Waterhouse says.
As I understand it, this RAM is just the part where you bury and disinter the data,
Comstock says, trying to master the higher harmonics in his own voice, trying to sound and act as if he saw this kind of thing daily.
If you had to give a name to the whole apparatus,
what would you call it?
Waterhouse says.
Well, this basic job is to perform mathematical calculations, like a computer.
Comstock snorts.
A computer is a human being.
Well, this machine uses binary digits to do its computing. I suppose you could call it a digital computer.
Comstock writes it out in block letters on his legal pad. Digital computer.
Oh, is this going to go into your report?
Waterhouse asks brightly. Comstock almost blurts, report?
This is my report.
Then a foggy memory comes back to him. Something about azure. Something about gold mines.
Ah, yeah, he murmurs.
Oh, yeah, there's a war on. He considers it.
Now that you mention it, this isn't even a footnote.
He looks significantly at his pair of hand-picked math whizzes who are gazing at the ram like a couple of provincial Judean sheep shearers getting their first look at the Ark of the Covenant.
We'll probably just keep these photos for the archives. You know how the military is with its archives.
Waterhouse goes into that dreadful laugh again.
Do you have anything else to report before we adjourn?
Comstock says, desperate to silence him.
Well, this work has given me some new ideas on information theory, which you might find interesting. Write them down. Send them to me. There's one other thing. I don't know if it is really germane here, but, what is it, Waterhouse?
Well, it seems that I'm engaged to be married.
Caravan. Randy has lost all he owned, but gained an entourage.
Amy has decided that she might as well come north with him, as long as she happens to be on this side of the Pacific Ocean. This makes him happy. The Shafto boys, Robin and Marcus Aurelius, consider themselves invited along. Like much else that in other families would be the subject of extended debate, this goes without saying, apparently. This makes it imperative that they drive the 1,000 or so miles to Whitman, Washington, because the Shafto boys are not really the sort who were in position to simply drop the hot rod off at the park and ride, run into the airport, and demand tickets on the next flight to Spokane. Marcus Aurelius is a college sophomore on an ROTC scholarship, and Robin's attending some kind of military prep school. But even if they did have that kind of money rattling around in their pockets, actually spending it would offend their native frugality. Or so Randy assumes for the first couple of days. It's the obvious assumption to make, given that the cash flow issue seems always to be on their mind. For example, the boys made Herculean efforts to consume every spoonful of the gut-busting vat of oatmeal cooked by Amy the morning after the quake, and, finding it beyond their endurance, they carefully decanted the remainder into a Ziploc bag while fretting at length about the high cost of Ziploc bags. And didn't Randy have any old glass jelly jars or something, somewhere in the basement, that might be unbroken and usable for this purpose? Randy has had plenty of time to disabuse himself of this fallacy, namely that the airplane avoidance is dictated by financial constraints, and to draw the real reason out of them after they have dropped Amy's U-Haul off near SFO and begun to caravan northwards in the Acura and the jacked-up, thundering Impala. People are rotated from car to car whenever they stop, according to some system that no one is divulging to Randy, but that always situates him alone in a car with either Robin or Marcus Aurelius. Both of them are too dignified to spill their guts on light pretexts, and too polite to assume that Randy gives a shit about anything they think, and perhaps too basically suspicious of Randy to share a whole lot with him. Some kind of bonding is required first. The ice doesn't start to break up until day two of the drive. After they have all slept in an Interstate 5 rest area near Reading in the reclined seats of the vehicles, each of the Shafto boys solemnly and separately informs him that the chain of lodgings known as Motel 6 is one giant con game, that if those rooms ever did cost $6 a night, which is doubtful, they certainly don't now, and many are the innocent young travelers who have been drawn in by the siren calls of those fraudulent signs rising above Interstate clover leaves. They tried to sound impartial and wise about it, but the way their faces flush and their eyes glance aside and their voices rise makes Randy suspect he is actually listening to some thinly veiled personal and recent history. Again, without anyone saying anything, it is taken to be obvious that Amy, as the female, will require her own car to sleep in, which puts Randy in the hot rod with Robin and Marcus Aurelius. As the guest, Randy gets the reclining passenger seat, the best bed in the house, and M.A. curls up on the back seat while Robin, the youngest, sleeps behind the steering wheel. For about the first 30 seconds after the dome light has gone off and the Shaftos have finished saying their prayers out loud, Randy lies there feeling the Impala rock on its suspension from the wake blasts of passing long-haul semis and feels considerably more alienated than he did while trying to sleep in the jeepney in the jungle town in northern Luzon. Then he opens his eyes, and it's morning, and Robin's out there doing one-handed push-ups in the dust.
"When we get there,"
Robin pants after he's finished,
"do you suppose you could show me that video on the internet thing you were telling me about?"
he asks, with all due boyishness. Then suddenly he looks abashed and adds,
"Unless it's real expensive or something."
"Well, it's free. I'll show it to you," Randy says. "Let's get some breakfast." For breakfast, they must drive to a small town, grocery stores in big places like Reading being a ripoff, and find an actual grocery store, convenience stores being etc., 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 and purchase breakfast in the most elemental form conceivable, deeply discounted well past their prime bananas that are not even in a bunch but swept up from the floor or something and gathered together in a gaily printed paper sack, and generic Cheerio knockoffs in a tubular bag and a box of generic powdered milk, and eat it from tin military surplus mess kits that the Shaftos produce with admirable coolness from the hot rod's trunk, A ferrous, oily chasm, all a-bang with tire chains, battered ammo boxes, and, unless Randy's eyes are playing tricks on him, a pair of samurai swords. Anyway, this is all done pretty nonchalantly, and not like they are trying to test Randy's mettle or anything, and so he doesn't imagine it qualifies as a true bonding experience. If, hypothetically, the Impala throws a rod in the desert and they have to fix it with parts stolen from a nearby junkyard guarded by rabid dogs and shotgun-packing gypsies, that would be a bonding experience. But Randy's wrong. On day two, the Shaftos, the male ones anyway, open up to him a bit. It seems, and this is abstracted from many hours of conversation, that when you are an able-bodied young male Shafto, and you are a stranger in a strange land with a car that you have, with plenty of advice and elbow grease from your extended family fixed up pretty nicely, the idea of parking it in favor of some other mode of conveyance is, in addition to obvious financial folly, some kind of moral failure, pure and simple. That's why they are driving to Whitman, Washington. But why, one of them finally summons the boldness to inquire, why are they taking two cars? There is plenty of room in the Impala for four. Randy has gotten the sense all along that the Shaftos are dismayed by Randy's insistence on taking the redundant and repulsively scarred Acura, and that only their formidable politeness has prevented them from pointing out the sheer madness of it. "I do not imagine that we will stay together beyond Whitman," Randy says. After being around these guys for a couple of days, he has begun to fall out of the habit of using contractions, those tawdry shortcuts of the verbally lazy and pathologically rushed. If we have two cars, we can split up at that point.
"The drive is not that far, Randall," says Robin,
slapping the Impala's gas pedal against the floor to rip the transmission into passing gear and careening around a gasoline tanker. From the initial Sir and Mr. Waterhouse, Randy has been able to talk them down into addressing him by his first name, but they have agreed to it only on the condition, apparently, that they use the full Randall instead of Randy. Early attempts to use Randall Lawrence as a compromise were vigorously denounced by Randy, and so Randall it is for now.
"M.A. and I would be happy to drop you back off at the San Francisco airport, or, well, wherever you elected to park your Acura."
"Where else would I park it?" Randy says, not getting this last bit.
"Well, I mean that you could probably find a place where you could park it free of charge for a few days if you did some looking around, assuming you wanted to keep it."
He adds encouragingly,
"That Acura probably would have some decent resale value even considering all the bodywork it needs."
Only at this point does Randy figure out that the Shaftos believe him to be utterly destitute, helpless, and adrift in the wide world. A total charity case. He recalls now seeing them discard a whole sack of McDonald's wrappers when they arrived at his house. This whole austerity binge has been concocted to avoid putting financial pressure on Randy. Robin and M.A. have been observing him carefully, talking about him, thinking about him. They happen to have made some faulty assumptions and come to some wrong conclusions, but all the same, they have shown more sophistication than Randy was giving them credit for. This causes Randy to go back and review the conversations he has had with them the last couple of days, just to get some idea of what other interesting and complicated things might have been going on in their heads. M.A. is a pretty straightforward by-the-book type, the kind who'll get good grades and fit well into any kind of hierarchical organization. Robin, on the other hand, is more of a wild card. He has the makings of either a total loser or a successful entrepreneur, or maybe one of those guys who will oscillate between those two poles. Randy realizes now, in retrospect, that he has spilled a hell of a lot of information to Robin in just a couple of days about the internet and electronic money and digital currency and the new global economy. Randy's mental state is such that he is prone to babbling aimlessly for hours at a time. Robin has hoovered it all up. To Randy, it's just been aimless ventilating. He hasn't even considered until now what effect it has been exerting on the trajectory of Robin Shafto's life. Randall Lawrence Waterhouse hates Star Trek and avoids people who don't hate it, but even so, he has seen just about every episode of the damn thing, and he feels, at this moment, like the Federation scientist who beams down to a primitive planet and thoughtlessly teaches an opportunistic pre-Enlightenment Yahoo how to construct a phaser cannon from commonly available materials. Randy still has some money. He cannot begin to guess how he can convey this fact to these guys without committing some grievous protocol error. So the next time they stop for gas, he asks Amy to convey it to them. He thinks, based on his hazy understanding of the rotation system, that it's his turn to be alone in a car with Amy, but if Amy is going to convey this data about the money to one of the boys, she'll need to spend the next leg with him, because it must be conveyed indirectly, which will take a while, and because of that indirectness, time will then need to be allotted for it to sink in. But 3 hours later, then, at the gas stop after that, it naturally follows that M.A. and Robin must be placed together in the same car, so that Robin, who now knows and understands, and who gets out of the Impala with a big grin on his face and punches Randy affably on the shoulder, can pass the message on to M.A., whose recent conversational gambits vis-a-vis Randy made no sense at all, until Randy figured out that they thought of him as a beggar and that M.A. was trying in a really oblique way to find out if Randy needed to share any of M.A.'s personal toiletry items. At any rate, Randy and Amy get into the Acura and they head north into Oregon, trying to keep up with the hot rod. "Well, it's nice to have a chance to spend some time with you," Randy says. His back is still a bit sore from where Amy struck him whilst asserting, the other morning, that expressing one's feelings was the name of the game. So he figures he will express those aspects of his feelings, least likely to get him in serious trouble.
"I figured you and I'd have plenty of time to chew the rag," Amy says,
having reverted utterly to the tongue of her ancestors in the last couple of days.
"But it's been ages and ages since I saw those two boys, and you've never seen them at all."
"Ages and ages? Really?"
"Yeah."
"How long?"
"Well, last time I saw Robin, he was just starting kindergarten. And I saw M.A. more recently. He was probably 8 or 10.
"And you are related to them how? One more time?"
"I think Robin is my second cousin. And I could explain M.A.'s relationship to me, but you'd start shifting around heaving great big sighs before I got more than halfway through it."
"So, to these guys, you are a shirt-tail relative they glimpsed once or twice when they were tiny little boys." Amy shrugs.
"Yeah."
"So, like, what possessed them to come out here?" Amy looks blank. "I mean," Randy says, "from the general attitude they copped when they fishtailed to a stop in the middle of my front yard and leapt out of their red-hot, bug-encrusted vehicle, fresh from Tennessee, obviously the number one mission objective was to ensure that the flower of Shafto womanhood was being treated with all of the respect, decency, worshipfulness, etc., properly owed it."
"Oh, that's not really the vibe that I got."
"Oh, it wasn't? Really?"
"No, Randy. My family sticks together. Just 'cause we haven't seen each other for a while doesn't mean our obligations have lapsed."
"Well, you are making an implied comparison to my family here, which I'm not that crazy about, and maybe we should talk about later. But as far as those family obligations go, I do certainly think that one of those obligations is to preserve your notional virginity."
"Who says it's notional?"
"It's got to be notional to them, because they haven't seen you for most of your life. That's all I mean."
"I think you are blowing the perceived sexual aspect of this thing way out of proportion," Amy says. "Which is perfectly normal for a guy, and I don't think less of you for it."
"Amy, Amy, have you done the math on this thing?"
"Math?"
"Counting the trip through Manila traffic to Naya, the check-in procedure, and formalities at SFO, my entire journey from Manila to San Francisco took me something like 18 hours, 20 for you. Another 4 hours to get down to my house. Then 8 hours after we got to my house, in the middle of the night, Robin and Marcus Aurelius showed up. Now, if we assume that the Shafto family grapevine functions at the speed of light, it means that these guys, shooting hoops in front of their trailer in Tennessee, received a news flash that a female Shafto was in some kind of guy-related personal distress at about the time you jumped off of Glory 4 and hopped in a taxi in Manila."
"I sent email from Glory," Amy says.
"To whom?"
"The Shafto mailing list."
"God!" Randy says.
slapping himself in the face.
What did this email say?
Can't remember, Amy says.
That I was headed for California. I might have made some kind of backhand remark about a young man I wanted to talk to. I was kind of upset at the time, and I can't remember exactly what I have said.
I think you said something like, I am going to California where Randall Lawrence Waterhouse, who has AIDS, is going to forcibly sodomize me upon arrival.
No, it was nothing of the kind.
Well, I think that someone read it between the lines. So anyway, Ma or Annie M or someone emerges from the side door shaking flour out of her gingham apron. I'm imagining this.
I can tell.
And she says, boys, your umpteenth cousin thrice removed America Shafto has sent us email from Uncle Doug's boat in the South China Sea stating that she is having some kind of dispute with a young man and it's not out of the question that she might need someone around to lend her a hand. In California. Would you swing by and look in on her? And they put away their basketball and say, yes, ma'am, what city and address? And she says, never you mind, just get on Interstate 40 and drive west, not failing to maintain an average speed of between 100 and 120% of the legal speed limit, and call me collect from a Texaco somewhere, and I will supply you with specific target coordinates later. And they say, yes, ma'am. And 30 seconds later, they are laying a patch in the driveway as they pull 5Gs back and out of the garage, and 30 hours subsequently, they are in my front yard, shining their 25D cell flashlights into my eyes and asking me a lot of pointed questions.
Do you have any idea how far the drive is?
I have no idea. Well, according to M.A.'s Rand McNally Road Atlas, it is an even 2,100 miles.
So? So that means that they maintained an average speed of 70 miles an hour for a day and a half.
A day and a quarter, Amy says.
Do you have any idea how difficult that is to do?
Randy, you push on the gas pedal and keep it between the lines. How hard is that? I'm not saying it's an intellectual challenge. I'm saying that this willingness to, e.g., urinate into empty McDonald's cups rather than stop the car, suggests a kind of urgency, passion even. And being a guy, and having had the experience of being a guy of the age of M.A. and Robin, I can tell you that one of the few things that gets your blood boiling to that extent is this notion of some female you love being done wrong by a strange male.
Well, what if they did? Amy says. Now they think you're okay.
They do? Really?
Yeah. The financial disaster aspect makes you more human, more approachable, and it excuses a lot.
Do I need an excuse for something?
Not in my book.
But to the extent that they thought I was a rapist, it kind of palliates my image problems. A brief lull in the conversation ensues. Then Amy pipes up.
So, tell me about your family, Randy.
In the next couple of days, you're going to learn a great deal more than I would like you to about my family. And so am I. So let's talk about something else.
Okay. Let's talk about business.
Okay, you go first.
We got a German television producer coming out next week to have a look at the U-boat. They might do a documentary about it. We've already hosted several German print journalists.
You have?
It has caused a sensation in Germany.
Why?
Because no one can figure out how it got there. Now, your turn.
We are going to launch our own currency.
By saying this, Randy is divulging proprietary information to someone not authorized to hear it. But he does it anyway, because opening himself up to Amy in this way, making himself vulnerable to her, gives him a hard-on.
How do you go about that? Don't you have to be a government?
No, you have to be a bank. Why do you think they're called banknotes?
Randy is fully aware of the insanity of divulging secret business information to a woman solely for purposes of sexual self-titillation, but it is in the nature of things right now that he doesn't especially care.
Okay. But still, usually it's done by government banks, right?
Only because people tend to respect the government banks, but government banks in Southeast Asia have a huge image problem right now. That image problem translates directly into crashing exchange rates.
So, how do you do it?
Get a big pile of gold, issue certificates saying this certificate can be redeemed for such and such an amount of gold. That's all there is to it.
What's wrong with dollars and yen and stuff?
The certificates, the banknotes,
are printed on paper. We're going to issue electronic banknotes.
No paper at all.
No paper at all.
So you can only spend it on the net.
Correct.
What if you want to buy a sack of bananas?
Find a banana merchant on the net.
Seems like paper money would be just as good.
Paper money is traceable and perishable and has other drawbacks. Electronic banknotes are fast and anonymous.
What's an electronic banknote look like, Randy?
Like any other digital thing. A bunch of bits.
Doesn't that make it kind of easy to counterfeit?
Not if you have good crypto, Randy says. Which we do.
How did you get it?
By hanging out with maniacs.
What kind of maniacs?
Maniacs who think that having good crypto is of near-apocalyptic importance.
How'd they get around to thinking any such thing?
By reading about people like Yamamoto who died because they had bad crypto and then projecting that kind of thing into the future.
Do you agree with them?
Amy asks. It might be one of those pivotal moment in the relationship questions. At 2 a.m, when I'm lying awake in bed, I do, Randy says. In the light of day, it all seems like paranoia.
He glances over at Amy, who's looking at him appraisingly because he hasn't actually answered the question yet.
He's got to pick one thing or the other.
Better safe than sorry, I guess.
Having good crypto can't hurt, and it might help.
And it might make you a lot of money along the way,
Amy reminds him. Randy laughs. At this point, it's not even about trying to make money, he says. I just don't want to be totally humiliated.
Amy smiles cryptically.
What?
Randy demands. You sounded just like a Shafto when you said that,
Amy says. Randy drives the car in silence for about half an hour after that. He was right, he suspects. It was a pivotal moment in the relationship. All he can do now is totally screw it up. So he shuts up and drives.
The General.
For 2 months, he sleeps on a beach on New Caledonia, stretched out under a mosquito net, dreaming of worse places, polishing his line. In Stockholm, someone from the British Embassy got him to a certain cafe. A gentleman he met in the cafe got him to a car. The car got him to a lake where a float plane just happened to be sitting with its motors running and its lights off. The Special Air Service got him to London. Naval Intelligence got him back to D.C., drained his brain, and turned him over to the Marines with a big stamp on his papers saying that he must never again be sent into combat. He knew too much to be taken prisoner. The Marines found that he knew too little to serve as a rear echelon motherfucker and gave him a choice, a one-way ticket home or higher education. He opted for the ticket home, then talked a green officer into believing that his family had moved and home was now San Francisco. You could practically cross San Francisco Bay by jumping from one Navy ship to the next. The waterfront was lined with the Navy's piers, depots, hospitals, and prisons. All of them were guarded by Shafto's military brothers. Shafto's tattoos were obscured by civilian clothes and his haircut grown out, but he only had to look a Marine in the eye from a stone's throw and that Marine would recognize him for a brother in need and open any gate for him, break any regulation, probably even lay down his life. Shafto stowed away on a ship bound for Hawaii so fast he didn't even have time to get drunk. From Pearl, it took him 4 days to get on a ship to Kwajalein. There, he was a legendary hero. His money was no good on Kwaj. He smoked, drank, and ate for a week without being allowed to spend a dime, and finally his brothers got him on a plane that took him a couple of thousand miles due south to Noumea in New Caledonia. They did so with great reluctance. They would willingly have hit a beach with him, but this was different. They were sending him perilously close to SOWESPAC, the Southwest Pacific Theater, the domain of the General. Even now, a couple of years after the General had sent them into action, poorly armed and poorly supported on Guadalcanal, Marines still spent approximately 50% of their waking hours talking about what a bad guy he was. He secretly owned half of Intramuros. He had become a billionaire from Spanish gold that his father had dug up when he'd been governor of the Philippines. Quezon had secretly named him post-war dictator of the archipelago. The general was running for president, and in order to win, he was going to start throwing battles just to make FDR look bad and blaming it all on the Marines. And if that didn't work, he'd come back to the States and stage a coup d'etat, which would be beaten back against enormous odds by the United States Marine Corps. Semper Fi! Anyway, his brothers got him to New Caledonia. Noumea is a neat French city of wide streets and tin-roofed buildings, fronting on a big harbor lined with mountainous dumps of nickel and chromium ore from gigantic mines up island. The place is about one-third Free French. There's pictures of De Gaulle all over the place. One-third American servicemen and one-third cannibals. Word on the street is that the cannibals have not eaten any white people in 27 years, so Bobby Shafto, sleeping out on that beach, feels almost as safe as he did in Sweden. But when he reached Noumea, he slammed into a barrier more impervious than any brick wall. The imaginary line between the Pacific Theater, Nimitz's turf, and so Westpac. Brisbane, the general's headquarters, is just a short, by Pacific standards, hop almost due west. If he can just get there and deliver his line, everything's going to be fine. During his first couple of weeks on the beach, he's stupidly optimistic. Then he's depressed for about a month, thinking he'll never get off this place. Finally, he starts to come around, starts to display adaptability again. He's had no luck getting on board a ship, but the amount of air traffic is incredible. Seems that the general likes airplanes. Shafto starts tailing flyboys. The MPs won't give him the time of day. He can't get into an Army NCO's club to save his life. But an NCO's club offers strictly limited entertainments. Customers in search of more profound satisfactions must leave the perimeter defined by hard-assed MPs and enter the civilian economy. And when horny, well-paid American flyboys are dropped into a culture defined half by cannibals and half by Frenchmen, you get a hell of a civilian economy. Shafto finds a vantage point outside an airbase gate, plants himself there, his pockets loaded with cigarette packs, the Marines on Quaj left him with a lifetime supply, and waits. Flyboys come out in twos and threes. Shafto picks out the sergeants, follows them to bars and whorehouses, sits down in their line of sight, begins to chain smoke. Before long, they've come over and started to bum cigarettes off him. This leads to conversations. Once he gets this routine figured out, he learns a lot about the 5th Air Force in a big hurry, makes a lot of friends. In a few weeks, he strikes the jackpot. He goes over the airfield fence at 1 a.m. of a moonless night, belly crawls for about a mile along the shoulder of a runway, and just barely makes a rendezvous with the crew of the Tipsy Tootsie, a B-24 Liberator bound for Brisbane. In fairly short order, he finds himself stuffed into the glass sphere at the tail of the plane, the rear ball turret. Its purpose, of course, is to shoot down Zeros, which tend to attack from behind, but Tipsy Tootsie's crew seems to think that they are about as likely to find Zeros around here as they would be over central Missouri. They warned him to wear something warm, but he didn't have anything of that nature. Tipsy Tootsie has barely left the runway when he begins to understand his mistake. The temperature drops like a 500-pound bomb. It is physically impossible for him to get out of the turret. Even if he could, it would just lead to his getting arrested. He has been smuggled on board without the knowledge of the officers who are actually flying the plane. Calmly, he decides to add prolonged hypothermia to his already extensive knowledge of suffering. After a couple of hours, he either loses consciousness or falls asleep, and this helps. He is awakened by pink light that comes from every direction at once. The plane has lost altitude, the temperature has risen, his body has thawed out enough to bring him awareness. After a few minutes, he's able to move his arms. He reaches into the pink glow and rubs condensation off the inside of the ball turret. He takes out a hanky, wipes the whole thing clean, and now he's looking straight down the throat of a Pacific dawn. The sky is streaked and mottled by black clouds, like jets of squid ink in a Caribbean cove. For a while, it's as if he is underwater with Bischoff. Puckered scars mar the Pacific in loops and lines, and he is reminded of his own naked flesh. But the hard, jagged pieces work their way out of the scar tissue like old shrapnel, coral reefs emerging from a shallowing sea. Warmer and warmer. He begins to shiver again. Someone has dumped brown dust into the Pacific, made a great pile of it. On the edge of the pile is a city. The city swings around them, comes closer. Warmer and warmer. It's Brisbane. A runway streaks up, and he thinks it's going to take his ass off, like the world's biggest belt sander. The plane stops. He smells gasoline. The pilot discovers him, loses his temper, and makes ready to call the MPs.
"I'm here to work for the general,"
Shafto mumbles through blue lips. It just makes the pilot want to slug him. But after Shafto has uttered these words, everything is different. The angry officers stand a pace or two farther away from him, tone down their language, knock off the threats. Shafto knows, from this, that the general does things differently. He spends a day recovering in a flophouse, then rises, shaves, drinks a cup of coffee, and strikes out in search of brass. To his extreme chagrin, he learns that the general has relocated his headquarters to Hollandia, in New Guinea. But his wife and son and a bunch of his staff are still staying at Lennon's Hotel. Shafto goes there and analyzes the traffic pattern. To pull into the hotel's horseshoe drive, the cars have to come around a particular corner just up the street. Shafto finds a good loitering place near that corner and waits. Looking through the windows of the approaching cars, he can see the epaulets. Count the stars and eagles. Seeing two stars, he decides to make his move. Jogging down the block, he reaches the awning of the hotel just as this general's door is being hauled open by his driver.
"Excuse me, General. Bobby Shafto reporting for duty, sir,"
he blurts, snapping out the perfectest salute in military history.
"And who the hell might you be, Bobby Shafto?"
says this general, hardly batting an eye. He talks like Bischoff. This guy actually has a German accent.
"I've killed more nips than seismic activity. I'm trained to jump out of airplanes. I speak a little nip. I can survive in the jungle. I know Manila like the back of my hand. My wife and child are there, and I'm kind of at loose ends, sir."
In London, in D.C., he had never have gotten this close. And if he had, he'd have been shot or arrested. But this is so Westpac. And so the next morning at dawn, he's on a B-17 bound for Hollandia, wearing army green, no rank. New Guinea is a nasty-looking piece of work. A gangrenous dragon with a wicked rocky spine covered with ice. Just looking at it makes Shafto shiver from a queasy combination of hypothermia and incipient malaria. The whole thing belongs to the general now. Shafto can plainly see that such a country could only be conquered by a man who is completely fucking out of his mind. A month in Stalingrad would be preferable to 24 hours down there. Hollandia is on the north shore of this beast, facing, naturally, towards the Philippines. It is well known throughout Marinedom that the general has caused a palace to be built for himself there. Some credulous fools actually believe the rumor that it is merely a complete 200% scale replica of the Taj Mahal built by enslaved Marines, but savvy jarheads know that it is actually a much vaster compound built out of construction materials stolen from Navy hospital ships, dotted with pleasure domes and fuckhouses for his string of Asiatic concubines, with a soaring cupola so high that the general can go up there and see what the nips are doing to his extensive real estate holdings in Manila, 1,500 miles to the northwest. Bobby Shafto sees no such thing out the windows of the B-17. He glimpses one large and nice-looking house up on a mountain above the sea. He supposes that it is a mere sentry post, marking the benighted perimeter of the general's domain. But almost immediately the B-17 bounces down a runway. The cabin is invaded by an equatorial miasma. It's like breathing cream of wheat direct from a blurping vat. Shafto feels his bowels loosening up already. Of course, there are many Marines who feel that army uniform trousers look best when feces stained. Shafto must put such thoughts out of his head. All the passengers, mostly colonels and better, move as to avoid working up a sweat, even though they are already drenched. Shafto wants to kick their fat, waffled butts downstairs. He's in a hurry to get to Manila. Pretty soon he is hitching a ride on the rear bumper of a Jeep full of brass. The airfield is still ringed with AK-AK guns, and shows signs of having been bombed and strafed not too long ago. Some of these signs are obvious physical evidence, like shell holes, but Shafto gets most of his information from watching the men, their posture, their facial expressions as they stare into the sky, tell him exactly what the threat level is. No wonder, he thinks, remembering the sight of that big white house up on the mountain. You can probably see that thing by moonlight, for Christ's sakes. It must be visible from Tokyo. It's just begging to be strafed. Then, as the Jeep begins to trundle up the mountain in first gear, he figures it out. That thing's just a decoy. The general's real command post must be a network of deep tunnels hidden beneath the jungle floor, and that is where you would have to look for your Asiatic concubines, etc. The trip up the mountain takes an eon. Shafto jumps off and soon outpaces the whining Jeep and the one in front of it. Then he's on his own, walking through the jungle. He'll just follow the tracks until they lead him straight to the cleverly camouflaged mineshaft that leads down to the general's HQ. The walk gives him plenty of time to have a couple of smokes and savor the unrelieved nightmarishness of the New Guinea jungle, compared to which Guadalcanal, which he thought was the worst place on earth, seems like a dewy meadow strewn with bunnies and butterflies. Nothing is more satisfying than to consider that the Nips and the United States Army spent a couple of years beating the crap out of each other here. Pity the Aussies had to get mixed up in it, though. The tracks take him straight to that big white clay pigeon of a house up on the mountainside. They've gone way overboard in trying to make the house look like someone's actually living there. Shafto can see furniture and everything. The walls are crisscrossed by bullet trails. They have even set up a mannequin on the balcony in a pink silk dressing gown, corncob pipe, and aviator sunglasses, scanning the bay through binoculars. As reluctant as he is to approve of anything done by the Army, Shafto cannot keep himself from laughing out loud at this witticism. Military humor at its finest. He can't believe they got away with it. A couple of press photographers are standing down below taking pictures of the scene. Standing in the middle of the house's mud parking lot, he plants his feet wide and thrusts his middle finger up at that mannequin. "Hey, asshole! This one's from the Marines on Kwajalein." Damn, this feels good. The mannequin swivels and aims its binoculars directly at Bobby Shafto, who freezes solid in his bird-flipping posture as if caught in the gaze of a basilisk. Down below, air raid sirens begin to weep and wail. The binoculars come away from the sunglasses. A puff of smoke blurts out of the pipe. The general snaps out a sarcastic salute. Shafto remembers to put his finger away, then stands there, rooted like a dead mahogany. The general reaches up and removes the pipe from his mouth so he can say, "Magandang gabi."
"Well, you mean magandang umaga," Shafto says. "Gabi means night, and umaga means morning."
The drone of airplane engines is now getting quite noticeable. The press photographers decide to pack it in and disappear into the house.
"When you're headed north from Manila towards Lingayen, and you get to the fork in the road at Tarlac, and you take the right fork there and head across the cane breaks towards Urdaneta, what's the first village you come to?"
"It's a trick question," Shafto says. "North of Tarlac, there are no cane breaks, just rice paddies."
Very good,"
the general says grumpily. Down below, the anti-aircraft guns open up with a fantastic clattering. From this distance, it sounds as if the north coast of New Guinea is being jackhammered into the sea. The general ignores it. If he were only pretending to ignore it, he would at least look at the incoming Zeros so that he could stop pretending to ignore them when it got too dangerous. But he doesn't even do so much as look. Shafto forces himself not to look either. The general asks him a big, long question in Spanish. He has a beautiful voice.
He sounds like he is standing in an anechoic sound booth in New York City or Hollywood, narrating a newsreel about how great he is.
If you're trying to find out if I hablo español, the answer is un poquito,
Shafto says. The general cups a hand to his ear irritably. He can't hear anything except for the pair of zeros converging on him and Shafto at 300-odd miles per hour, liquefying tons of biomass with dense streams of 12.7-millimeter slugs. He keeps a sharp eye on Shafto as a trail of bullets thuds across the parking lot, spraying Shafto's trouser legs with mud. The same line of bullets makes a sudden upwards right-angle turn when it reaches the wall of the general's house, climbs straight up the wall, tears out a chunk of the balcony's railing about a foot away from where the general's hand is resting, beats up a bunch of furniture back inside the house, and then clears the roof of the house and vanishes. Now that the planes have passed overhead, Shafto can look at them without having to worry that he is giving the general the idea that he is some kind of lily-livered pansy. The meatballs on their wings broaden and glower as they bank sharply, sharper than any American plane, and come round for a second try.
I said,
the general begins, but then the atmosphere is riven by a series of bizarre whizzing noises. One of the house's windows is suddenly punched out of its frame. Shafto hears a thud from inside and some crockery breaking. For the first time, the general shows some awareness that a military action is taking place.
Warm up my jeep, Shafto, he says. I have a bone to pick with my AAA boys.
Then he turns around and Shafto gets a look at the back of his pink silk dressing gown. It is embroidered in black thread with a giant lizard rampant. The general suddenly turns around.
Is that you screaming down there, Shafto?
Sir, no, sir.
I distinctly heard you scream.
MacArthur turns his back on Shafto again, giving him another look at the lizard, which on second thought might be some sort of Chinese dragon design, and goes inside the house, mumbling irritably to himself. Shafto gets into the vehicle indicated and starts the engine. The general emerges from the house and begins to plod across the lot, cradling an unexploded anti-aircraft shell in his arms. The wind makes his pink silk dressing gown billow all around him. The zeros come back and strafe the parking lot again, cutting a truck nearly in half.